ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Jason DeRosso here. Welcome to The Screen Show. In a somber week, because we lost the actor Sam Neill, who Australians kind of adopted. He died in Sydney this week, aged 78, and there have been tributes all over the place. But we wanted to do something different and make the most of our unique archive here at The Screen Show. So we're going to play you an interview with Sam Neill that you won't hear anywhere else. Back in 2009, I got Sam Neill to come into the studio and tell me about his favourite film. Not one of the films he starred in, but the one he most liked to watch, that he admired. I'll leave you guessing its title for now, but it was directed by Alfred Hitchcock. That's all I'll say. You'll hear that interview in just a few minutes. But we're going to start the show this week with my thoughts on The Odyssey.
Tell me what you remember.
A wife? A son.
And then what?
We won the war. Help me go home.
So I went to the premiere of The Odyssey in Sydney and found myself sitting in front of the biggest screen in New South Wales. Who knows, maybe the whole of the Southern Hemisphere, at the IMAX Theatre in Darling Harbour. And I found myself thinking, if this is big budget Hollywood spectacle, then Hollywood spectacle is in trouble. There I was looking up at a close up of Matt Damon's face. And I'm thinking, why do we need a screen this big to show so little? No offense, Matt. And then when we do cut to long shots, there's not that much to see. Parched Mediterranean landscapes and fairly unimpressive castles, I've got to say, all depicted in this unrelenting regime of beige and ochre. Perhaps this is Nolan's idea of how to root The Odyssey in gritty realism, but it's like an AI-designed wellness website. When Charlize Theron appears as Calypso walking along a beach, it's like she could be advertising a perfume. And the same could be said for Zendaya, who plays Athena. Just think, The Odyssey releases weeks after two much smaller, cheaper films directed by YouTubers, no less, Backrooms and Obsession, broke all kinds of box office records. And so you wonder what Christopher Nolan has paid hundreds of millions of dollars to achieve here. Once upon a time, in the silent era, films like Gantz's Napoleon or Griffith's Intolerance gave us sets that could take your breath away, filled with real live extras. Griffith's 1916 movie had a set for Ancient Babylon that was so big the studio couldn't afford to dismantle it for years, and it towered over the Los Angeles suburbs until the city finally ordered its removal as a fire hazard. There's nothing of that grand scale here, except the Blast Furnace soundtrack, the likes of which I haven't heard since Interstellar, which almost had me plugging my ears. So why has Nolan made this? Well, of course, you can understand the appeal of Homer's epic poem for the director of Oppenheimer and Inception. It's a dynamic storytelling exercise, leaping in and out of timelines with gods, monsters, philosophy, and heroism. Nolan, to his credit, choreographs a handful of sequences that will have you on the edge of your seat, including the Battle of Troy, where arrows and men's bodies fly through frame. And I particularly liked the CGI Cyclops too, with his vertical slit eye. On the home front, back in Ithaca, the film is less convincing. Anne Hathaway, excellent but slightly underwritten, is Penelope, a woman still yearning for her missing war hero husband, convinced he's still alive, while scores of uncouth suitors squat in her husband's palace, waiting for her hand in marriage. Among them, a predictably slimy Robert Pattinson. Tom Holland plays Odysseus's son, who sets out on a voyage to find his father, a framing device that introduces us to Helen of Troy and her sister, both played by a terrific Lupita Nyong'o. But Nolan seems most inspired in the company of Odysseus and his cursed band of brothers, on their journey home across the seas.
No one could stand between me and home. Not even the gods.
Keep us free!
I'd like to take a moment here to compare Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey with the 1954 film Ulysses, which, by the way, was filled with rich colour and spectacle. Ulysses was haunted by the recent end of World War II, and I always thought that Kirk Douglas expressed a sense of survivor's guilt in that film, mixed with the post-war era's newfound humanist optimism. It's why there's such an emphasis in that movie on the encounter with the witch Circe, played by Silvana Mangano, who, incidentally, also plays Ulysses' wife Penelope in the movie. She's a sorceress who turns men into pigs and offers Ulysses eternal life in the film.
Listen to me. I shall give you something that will make you forget all your petty dreams. Your miserable kingdom, your wife who grows old. Remain. And this very night, Olympus shall welcome a new god, Ulysses.
Immortal.
This is my gift. The greatest gift that has ever been offered to a man.
He refuses because he's more interested in living this life well.
No.
In honour of those, his fallen comrades, who no longer can. When Circe appears in Nolan's film, with a nicely weird turn from Samantha Morton, the encounter does not have the same impact, and is also not the same offer of eternity. What the films do have in common is that Douglas and Damon both have a corny streak of American male self-confidence with a grin to match. It works well for the comeuppance that's in store for them. But it also expresses a side of their character that joyously embraces action. Nolan's film is about the consequences of action, the grief that follows. But it's more about a grief for an idea than a grief for people. That idea is a vision of the world and its rules-based order. In the movie, this order, this shared vision of civility, is symbolised by the law of Zeus, the law of hospitality, which various characters refer to and some take for granted, while others flout it brazenly. In the final scenes, Matt Damon channels a sincere sense of regret. He laments, "We lived in a world of palaces and trade, blind to its beauty, and we broke it." Or as Joni Mitchell sang, "You don't know what you've got till it's gone." This thought will no doubt resonate with contemporary audiences who share some of the anxieties about our own rules-based order. Christopher Nolan, in this sense, has reinvigorated Homer's ancient story for a modern-day audience. If only he was able to reinvigorate the Hollywood spectacle movie in the process.
Promise me you will come back.
What if I can't?
The Odyssey is out now. You're listening to The Screen Show on ABC Radio National with me, Jason DeRosso. Well, now to Sam Neill, who died this week. The Northern Irish-born New Zealander became fond of this country and Australians fond of him. He was such a central presence to so many important Australian films, especially in that late 70s, 80s period. Films like My Brilliant Career, Dead Calm, Death in Brunswick, and more. Who could forget him too, in the film directed by his fellow New Zealander Jane Campion, The Piano. Sam Neill was a performer with an amazing range, and he possessed a pair of eyebrows he could manipulate like a master musician their instrument. He could seem arch, malevolent, self-deprecating, funny, or deadly serious. The great James Mason saw him in My Brilliant Career and was so impressed he paid for airfares for Neill and his wife to come visit in Switzerland. And he was an early mentor who helped him get the role in his first breakout Hollywood film, The Omen 3, in which he played Damien. Much Hollywood success followed, including Jurassic Park and The Hunt for Red October. There were late career triumphs on the small screen too, in The Tudors and Peaky Blinders. My favourite performance of his remains the one he delivered in the psychological horror Possession from 1981, a film about a disintegrating marriage, directed by the Polish director Andrzej Żuławski, in which Neil starred opposite a career best Isabella Gianni. A quote that's been doing the rounds this week is ascribed to Neil himself, in which he describes himself as deep as a wash basin. But there was nothing further from the truth, as you're about to hear in this next discussion. Certainly on screen too, Neil's performances possessed a depth and sophistication, even when playing the most restrained characters. The conversation you're about to hear was recorded in 2009 when he came into the studios at ABC Radio National and spoke about his favourite film, Hitchcock's 1946 spy noir, Notorious. Set in post-war Brazil, it stars Ingrid Bergman as the daughter of a Nazi sympathiser who's enlisted by the American Secret Service to seduce one of her father's old friends, played by Claude Rains, and find out more about his business dealings. She falls for her handler, played by Cary Grant, and he for her, but, of course, it's the sinister Claude Rains that she has to marry. Sam Neill.
If I'm asked, what's your favourite film ever? This is the one that sort of pops up because I think it was the first film I saw as a boy. But I thought, what a fantastic thing film is. So I looked at it again last weekend, and I can see what fascinated, you know, all the tension that's gone because I know how the story resolves. So don't go there, you know, don't go into the wine cellar, don't kiss him now, and don't sit on that park bench with him, it's dangerous. All that sort of thrilling stuff is gone. But I can, as an actor now, I can see what phenomenal performances these are, particularly from Ingrid Bergman. Her scenes with Cary Grant, where you see her falling in love with him very, very quickly, but for the experience of the story, are extraordinarily beautifully played. The kisses, for instance.
Oh, the kisses
are
great.
Which are so sexy and so romantic, and so, there's something about her that is overwhelming. You just want to, you know, this is the woman you want to live with for the rest of your life. She's fantastic.
It's nice out here. Let's not go out for dinner. Let's stay here.
We have to eat.
What you need here? I'll cook.
I thought you didn't like to cook.
No, I don't like to cook. But I have a chicken in the icebox and you're eating it.
There's that beautiful, I think it's one of the first kisses, if not the first kiss, where they both have just arrived in Rio de Janeiro. And the camera follows this, well, it's part conversation, it's part embrace. It lasts seconds and seconds and seconds, you know. And she keeps pecking him on the lips. Of course, they had to get around that rule. I think it was a 3-second rule. They couldn't have kisses longer than that on screen for that at that in that time. But yeah. They get around it beautifully by having these intermittent pecks.
Yeah, and she's so sensual in that, and you can see she wants to taste him and eat him up. You know, it's fabulous. And there is another kiss later on where. They've entered the wine cellar. They think they've got out of it, but they've been caught by Claude Rains. Now, Claude Rains is another actor I like very much. When he pops up, I know I'm going to enjoy his performance, and he's very good in this. And albeit he's Nazi and all that, you don't want him to die.
He's almost charismatic, isn't he? I mean, he's...
It's beautifully understated. Yeah. Now, Claude Rains catches them. They've just come out of the wine cellar.
Alex, he's seen us.
And Cary Grant sweeps her into his arms. And he says...
Wait a minute. I'm going to kiss you.
No, he'll only think we...
That's what I want him to think.
They both know it's actually better to be caught as adulterers than to be caught as spies. As adulterers, they'll get away with their lives. As spies, they will die. So they kiss in order to hide what they've really been up to there. And the kiss, because she loves him so much, turns into a real kiss away from Claude Rains, and only we can see it because we're the audience. What a marvelous, magical moment that is.
Of course, we know that there is this love between them, and they're both, well, part of this film really is about an exercise in denial for both of them, because professionally they need to sort of deny it.
Mm.
And it's unleashed really here, yeah, isn't it? In a very subtle way.
The film's all about who knows what and when. And then who knows that the other person knows. It's fabulously constructed. There are many things that have Hitchcock's stamp on them, the genius of Hitchcock. One of them is you remember she wakes up with a hangover and there's a really scary shot of Cary Grant at the door. And as he walks up to the bed and she hits her point of view, he turns upside down. It's an incredibly marvelous, disturbing shot. Now, the ending is very Hitchcockian too. And Hitchcock turns everything on its head here. And instead of the lovers driving off to the sunset, they just exit screen left. And Claude Rains, poor Claude Rains, one of the other Nazis, says, "Would you care to join us inside?" And he walks into the sunset, not just of his life, but it's the end of his life. You know that he's got another minute to live. Poor Claude Rains. And he walks reluctantly away from us, and the door closes and it's gone. So it's a very different kind of sunset ending.
And it is, isn't it? Because it's really, the undertone here is one of, oh, great tragedy for the Claude Rains character, even though he's a Nazi and his politics are evil and essentially he's a bit of a coward too. We have grown to like him in some strange way.
You feel sorry for him. It's not that you like him, but you feel sorry for him. I love that ending. It just happens with such dispatch, done and dusted, and good night, go home.
From 2009, discussing his favourite film, Hitchcock's 1946 noir, Notorious, the late, great Sam Neill. You're on The Screen Show with me, Jason DeRosso, brought to you by ABC Radio National. Finally, this week, we're looking ahead to next month's Melbourne International Film Festival and a beautiful, moving film that captures something very profound and authentic about contemporary life for so many people, in all its joy, in all its messiness and sorrow. It's a film about a French family, a mother and daughter in particular, and two very important ceremonies. One is the daughter's wedding in France, an exuberant, if not always convivial, gathering of extended family and friends. The other is the funeral of the family patriarch, an extended traditional ceremony that takes place over a couple of days in his African village. The film is called Dao, that's spelt D-A-O, and in various video snippets we see of some of the non-professional actors in the cast auditioning for the roles, we get a sense of how the movie approaches fiction as a way of mediating authentic lived experience. This is a political movie in many senses, but notably, it is an exercise in self-representation for people who don't normally see themselves on screen. Its director, Alain Gomis, was in Australia last month presenting this movie at the Sydney Film Festival, and I caught up with him in his hotel.
Je m'appelle Gloria, j'ai 50 ans, j'ai une fille. Pourquoi est-ce que tu veux te marier? Dis-moi. Bienvenue dans ton village.
Alain Gomis, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you, happy to be with you.
This is a real miracle of a film, it seems. I mean, it's such a precious document. And I'm wondering if it feels like a miracle to you now that you've made it.
Oh, I mean, the shooting was really pretty amazing. And it was an everyday surprise because a lot of things were improvised. And for me, it was the weird experience of discovering the film day after day. And it was fantastic.
The overall impression you have, of course, is that this is a film in two timelines, revolving around two different ceremonies, a funeral and a wedding. And you do have this overwhelming impression that it was shot in the temporal space of the actual occasion. How long did the shoot actually take?
20 days, 10 days in each places.
And so you also include drawing back the curtain a bit in a sort of postmodern way, or a deconstruction in a sort of gesture of deconstruction. You also include in the film the interviews with the performers. Why that decision? Was that always part of the film?
Yes. I mean, when I have started to write, I realized that it was almost impossible for me and a little bit stupid to try to write for everybody. It's like 200 people, four generations, men and women, two continents. And to have like all these people talking with my words, it's very weird. So I was very much more interested by what they had to say. And it was also the possibility for me to ask them which way they wanted to be portrayed. Because this is the kind of community who have suffered a lot about the image carry about them and the type of, you know, characters or role that most of the time they have to carry on in cinema or things. So I was asking them, for example, what kind of character they wanted to play or what kind of character they didn't want to play. And, you know, men most of the time said things like, I don't want to be a gangster, I don't want to be a drug dealer. And women say, I don't want to be a beaten woman. So it says something about, you know, how sometimes in cinemas, the African people, diaspora, are like very reduced to some, you know.
A narrow spectrum of cliches.
Yeah, exactly. And this film was also a way of, you know, getting back the narrative, you know, taking back the image and be doing a kind of conscious fiction. And yes, to say we want to appear this way. This is us as we want to be portrayed.
Of course, the problem is that that's very dangerous for you, isn't it? Because if they're too attached to how they want to be portrayed, then at a certain point, that the danger is that that can maybe obfuscate truth. And what is remarkable, given what you've just said, is that there are parts of this film that actually are very honest about some elements of dysfunction, let's say, in this big gathering, in this community, which I thought was interesting, including domestic. But I mean, you mentioned the women didn't want to be presented as being battered women. However, there's quite a frank discussion, I think, in the African section especially, about misogyny.
Yep.
And even domestic violence.
Yeah. They have chosen to talk about it. I didn't told them to talk about this subject, you know, this topic. And they have chosen at some point in front of the camera to share this kind of story because they wanted to bring it to the knowledge of everybody and to be able to maybe have, I mean, beginning a kind of dialogue. And yes, I was very happy about it, that the fact that they were confident enough to bring it here. And what I'm happy about it also, it's traveling with the film, is to see that people watching the film, and especially women during this part, are connecting to this woman, not as, you know, ethnological or whatever thing, but as part of themselves. And this is a dialogue that most of the time appears to happen in the other side, you know, like African people or diaspora are used to recognize themselves into white characters. And I'm happy that for this time, I can have like a lot of people, European people, not connected directly to Africa, saying this is my family too.
Tell me about how you set about. Where did this concept come from? It reminded me a little bit of the kind of cinema that was being made in France in the 70s with Rivette and Out One and around that era, you know, where we have that blurring of characters and actors playing characters and the actors become blurred with the characters they're playing and that sort of thing. Do you see this film as being kind of part of that tradition of that very deconstructed approach to cinema, that blurring of fact and fiction?
I think that this kind of, I mean, these forms and especially form that interrogates the fiction itself, appears too into the anti-colonial cinema. You can see, I mean, there's this film, for example, in Maroc, Certaines Choses Sans Importance. I don't know the English title of it. It's a Moroccan film of the 60s, and you see into the film themselves. They want to make a film, then you see it in the film, and they integrate, and then at some point they ask, I mean, they want to have a hero, but they say, but a hero is bourgeois, a hero come from the Western world. And, you know, this way to interrogate the fiction and the shape of the fiction, the format of the fiction, as, I mean, if you want to say what we have to carry or what we want to share, we have also to invent our own grammar. If we use the normal grammar, we will not be able to reach you with the same power intensity, because it's like another version of a film that you have seen before. And if we have to be very specific, and this is very difficult today into the cinema industry, the way it works, everybody wants to have like another, I don't know, Star Wars or whatever. Their way to work is trying to, you know, you hear a lot of time, oh, this film is the is the mixture of Star Wars and, I don't know, Harry Potter. And, you know, this is the way the industry works. And that's terrible, in fact, because you can't have like a true feelings, emotion doing film this way. So I think it's very important for every filmmaker, not only African or whatever, to try to have its own, his own grammar in order to reach the audience in a way that, I mean, I want that every spectator see the film and saying, I've never seen that before. This is the first time.
How far apart were the two shoots, the African shoot and the European shoot?
The first shooting? It was in Guinea-Bissau.
But, and how far apart were the shoots between?
A few weeks, two or three weeks.
So you would gather many of the characters again for, well, the central characters are in both the African shoot and the European shoot. Yes. And so they had a break in between.
Yeah, like 2 weeks, something like that.
How many cameras did you use?
Most of the time one, but we had a second camera because the set was very open. It was not only happening in front of the camera, you know, it was happening everywhere. We had a way of shooting with no silence, no action, no cut. It was like, let's go, let's leave it. It was like, at some point it became a true wedding and a true ceremony. And it was funny sometimes that the actors, especially the one who doing the part of the bride and the groom.
Bride and the groom, yeah.
The groom was saying to me, do you know that between the takes, people are continuing to come to us to give us some advices about life, you know?
As if they were real newlyweds.
Real. And, you know, yeah, sometimes it was very disturbing in some ways, you know. Fiction is fantastic for that. You can go into situation, you can interrogate yourself, you can enter into very deep interaction that sometimes are very difficult to have in your daily life. You're like ready for that. So a son can ask questions to his father that he never have been able to ask before. So fiction can be a tool also for us to be able to reach some region of ourselves or our history, our heritage. And it was also where the possibility for us to ask questions.
The thing I like about the European setting too is that given that this is a film in Africa, it's obvious that this is a film really reflecting on colonialism. It's reflecting on the changes that have occurred culturally across the generations. It's reflecting on the process of modernization, of industrialization, and the disappearance of certain aspects of cultural knowledge. And then in the European section, I thought subliminally, there's this really interesting aspect to the setting, because it seems to me to be a converted farm of some kind, like a nice farm with big buildings. And so also there, even though it's a beautiful location for a wedding, and you can tell it's used all the time for weddings and lavish sort of conferences and stuff, there's this reminder of a kind of cultural residue, which is part of the theme of the film. Was that chosen deliberately for that reason?
Yeah, I mean, to me, to put in mirror these two ceremonies show also something about tradition is what we do today. Tradition is, I mean, we are reinventing tradition at each ceremony. If you have to marry, if you do your own wedding, you will have to choose your clothes, you will have to choose the place, you will have to choose to make this wedding that looks like you. And even for the ceremony in Guinea-Bissau, that's the same in some. It's very important to put tradition in the present, in the modernity, it's a movement. And so, yes, some parts are lost, but it's not the thing that's important. What is important is as a community to reinvent the past together. That's what we all do. That's what cinema do by retelling the same story again and again and again. That's what we are. It's part of us being alive.
And when Samir Goesmi comes on into your film, I know that there are other professional actors, but I really like him as an actor. He was great when he comes on and playing, well, one of the men from the past of this woman. The film focuses on a mother, a 50-year-old mother, and her daughter who's about to get married, and this woman's father has just died, which is why they've travelled to Africa. But anyway, that's the focus. She isn't a professional performer, but when Samir Goesmi comes on as a former, partner, I won't spoil it, they're great together. Did that surprise you? She really is good with him, and he's excellent because he's such a fabulous actor. He's maybe my favorite French contemporary actor, but yeah.
Yeah, Samir is a friend, one of my best friends. So yeah, I asked him to come, and he was there also during the casting rehearsal, helping the non-actor to be comfortable. And so we kept some of the thing we have tried during the rehearsal to some of the scene happened to be to happen during the casting, and we have to, decided to keep it for the shooting. So yes, I like this relationship between actors that bring confidence and the non-actors that bring a kind of truth. You know, they are true. It's just right now. And
well, the mother is, she's a tough woman. She's been divorced. She's maybe been a single mother, working class woman. And whoever, you've chosen this woman to play this role. And she has that focus and that determination in her screen presence.
Yeah.
She doesn't look nervous, right?
No.
Of course. But she, and so Goesmi plays a little bit of a, the word in English is a cad. He's not been a great guy. And she almost drills him with her eyes. She's very intense.
Yeah, she's very good.
What's her name?
Kati Koya. And she's very, very, very good. And all of them are very good. When actors or non-actors are confident about the process, they can give to the camera fantastic things, emotions, and I'm very glad that into this film you can meet so many people who have given so much. There's a lot of joy, but a lot of different emotion into the film, and I'm glad and I'm thankful for what they have given to us.
But also, and thank you for the film on behalf of all the audiences that will enjoy it, because you've really captured something very special and unique about a family living across continents, a reality of a family and the different generations of that family, the history. It's very, you've really captured something amazing in this film, and it's quite an achievement. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. This was really one of the goals of the film, to talk about this kind of, we're all from this kind of family, in fact. We're all made of different parts. And that's a shame that most of the time we are asked to choose, you know, we're supposed to say, I'm this or I'm that. In fact, I'm this and I'm that 100%. And I feel great about that.
Thank you, Alain.
Thank you very much.
Alain Gomis, his wonderful film, Dao, that's spelled D-A-O, is screening at next month's Melbourne International Film Festival. Do yourselves a favour, go out and see it. It is a wonderful film. And speaking of the Melbourne International Film Festival, in the minutes we have left, we're going to hear about some more highlights from this year's festival from senior programmer Kate Jinks, who joins me now. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Jason, and wonderful to hear about Dao. That was such a highlight for me at Berlin this year. Beautiful film.
Beautiful film. Tell me about some more highlights coming up at the Melbourne International Film Festival this year.
I'm particularly excited this year about our lineup for our Bright Horizons competition for first and second features. There is just some stunning films in there, and it's wonderful that some of the best films in our program are by new kind of emerging directors. Some favorites in there, The Friend's House is Here, which is this incredible Iranian film, which is kind of like a hangout film about these two friends who are artists in kind of contemporary Tehran who every kind of art they make is essentially resistance. It's a great film. It was smuggled out of Iran to premiere at Sundance, and we'll have the directors over. So I think that will be a big hit. Also, Josephine by Beste Arao, also from Sundance. Fantastic film. I have a big love for the film Goodbye, Cruel World. It's the first feature by Felix de Givry, an actor turned filmmaker. You might remember he starred in Mia Hansen Loves Eden
in
2014. And he's just got this beautiful film that stars the young actor who played Sandra Huller's son in Anatomy of a Fall. And it's kind of a breakthrough role for him as this teenager who is being bullied at school. He's kind of lost his footing in life and he tries to end it all and it doesn't work. And then he essentially hides out. But it looks like this kind of lost French New Wave film. It's all shot on Super 16 by one of Daft Punk's sons. It's a bit of an all-star situation. Another beautiful French film is La Gradiva by Marine Atlan, cinematographer turned filmmaker. That kind of won the big prize at Critics Week at Cannes this year, and just absolutely beautiful group of teenagers on a school trip to Pompeii. And then Australian film, Sweet Milk Lake, Harvey Zielinski's first feature, and also locally, kind of, Big Girls Don't Cry by Paloma Schneiderman, New Zealand director. And then we've got Blue Heron, which I know people are very excited about seeing. This film, Sophie Arimvari, who's a Hungarian-Canadian filmmaker, and it's just been sort of caught on like wildfire across the world, played a lot of festivals. So we're very excited that she'll be coming out as well. And that will be, in our competition, along with many other films.
Bright Horizons does look really tantalizing, very, very tasty this year. But tell me, just before we go, there's a number of retrospectives and one that's really close to your heart.
Yeah, I put together a strand called Ulrika Oettinger Radical Travels, and it's a kind of selection of the, she's 84 now, she's still making films. She has a new film this year, The Blood Countess, but I've chosen some of her more fantastical films from the 70s and 80s, Joanna d'Arc of Mongolia, Madame X, An Absolute Ruler, Ticket of No Return, and she's also picked some films for MIFF to screen, so that's quite exciting. We also have retrospectives on Lissandro Alonso, who will be coming out as a guest, and
the
Kim
Argentine
Novak
filmmaker.
As well.
Oh, and Kim Novak. Yeah. Fantastic. An embarrassment of riches. Thanks as always, Kate.
Thanks, Jason.
Kate Jinks, senior programmer at the Melbourne International Film Festival. That's it for the Screen Show for this week. Thanks as always to producer Sarah Corbett. I'm Jason DeRosso. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.